I apologize, we're starting a little bit late. I'm trying to do the best we can to be on time since our time is limited, and we want to do the best we can to make use of it. Thank you all for being prompt and for being here this morning. What we're doing today, we are going to hear from our newly appointed Commissioners of Health and Human Services. We're going to complete, last time we met, Dr. Golden and Ms. Miner were making a presentation, and we were a little short of time, so we're going to ask them to continue and give us the presentation that they were doing last week. And then we're going to conclude with a continuation of the budget overview from Mr. Albrecht. And so I would like to invite Commissioner Jessen, if she would like to join us initially and come to the witness table. And thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know it's been recently that you were asked to assume this task, and I really appreciate your taking the time after such a recent tenure in office to come over and introduce yourself. And what we really are hoping for is that you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and about what your thoughts are about the department, and actually anything you want to tell us. But so I'm just going to turn the time over to you and invite you to say whatever that you would like to tell us. But thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Senator, and thank you to the committee. I really appreciate this opportunity. I must say, this is my fourth day in the job, my fourth working day, so this is all a little new.
Excuse me, just one. Could you pull your microphone a little bit closer to you? This room is notorious for its acoustical issues, so that would help us. Thank you.
Thank you. I was saying this is day four for me on the job, so this is all a little new to me, though I didn't realize until I was coming here this morning that part of that newness would be navigating the tunnels to get to the Capitol and finding the rooms. So I'm trying to get through from the department. And fortunately, because I am a lawyer by training, I run into the Chief Justice, who then guides me here. I told her I think that's what we need to do in state governance, more people that are willing to serve really in two roles, both Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court and tour guide. So my presence here is partly due to Chief Justice Gil Day. Let me take the opportunity to just share a bit about my background. I am a lawyer by training. I graduated from law school in 1983. I went to work for a downtown Minneapolis law firm, Oppenheimer, Wolf & Donnelly, associate partner there. And after 10 years, they're about to give me my plaque, you know, for being there for 10 years. And I thought, wait, the reason I went to law school was really about public service, not about being a partner in a big firm. And so I actually came over and met here in the Capitol with then Chief Deputy John Thunheim in the Attorney General's office about a job working for the Attorney General's office, which was just one of my favorite jobs I've had, though I think this could maybe is going to overtake it. And my first client was the Department of Human Services. Now, so it opened up this new world to me that I certainly hadn't had so much in my private practice, where I'd represented, you know, individuals, but also a lot of businesses. And so I came to know the arcane world of Medicaid financing. I remember when I sat down and they said, we're having this new contracting system called PMAP contracts. You know, we want you to take a look at those. And so I really, and then I got to work also in the mental health areas and other parts of the department. I worked for 5 years. Though I started out as just an assistant, I did become Deputy Attorney General with responsibility for healthcare and licensing, and also worked with the Departments of Health, all the health licensing boards, and the Public Utilities Commission. I mean, it was kind of interesting, the things that came my way. I left that job at the end of Attorney General Humphrey's tenure as Attorney General, and went over and became Chief Deputy County Attorney in Hennepin County, where I ran the day-to-day office for then County Attorney Klobuchar as she was starting her job as county attorney. And so I was served in that in 2 years. And there I really saw not only, I mean, I opened my eyes to a lot of different things. For one thing, I had to switch from appearing in front of the health committees to being in front of the crime committees in the legislature. I'm so happy to be back here with all of you. Though it was interesting, but I did learn a lot about our criminal justice system, certainly, but also about a lot of our human services system from the county perspective. You know, so, and I'm the sort of person I want to like dive in and just learn by doing. So I went and I tried some child support cases, and I did the truancy hearings, and I did the hold hearings in child protection cases to really understand what our office did as we serve the county in those important human services functions. So I'm hoping, one of the things I'm hoping that will help me do is really understand where the counties are coming from, because that's such an important partnership with the department and as we deliver these important human services. Then I went back and started my own law firm because I love starting new things here in St. Paul. And after that, but when Hamline University offered me the opportunity to start a new health law institute, working on both policy and law and training our students not only to be good lawyers, but to be thoughtful leaders in our community, I chose to do that. And so I wasn't intending to be here because Hamline, the faculty just voted to give me tenure in December. I joked with the governor that, you know, he had a four-year term. I had, you know, a job for life. So it was a surprise to me when, the governor asked me to think about this job. But I'm here because I truly care about the work of the department and particularly have concerns about the many people it serves. And when I come at what I know are going to be hard decisions for all of us this session, I want to think about those in terms of not just numbers, but the faces of the individuals that we serve through our health care, with our mental illness, with our the citizens with disabilities, the children that we protect. But I also want to think about how we can do it differently. You know, I think that the department has a history of doing things that are innovative and cutting edge. If you think about many of the health reforms that they're talking about at the federal level, a lot of those ideas actually people in Minnesota were talking about, many of you were talking about across the years. When we think about welfare reform, that's something that we were a leader on, or delivering services to the individuals with disabilities in the community rather than in large institutions. Again, really innovative work, and I want to continue. And so that's why when I've been in these meetings my first few days, I've been just asking a lot of questions about why. Why do we do it this way? And sometimes there are good reasons, and sometimes it's because that's just the way historically it's been done. And I want to ask those questions to think about what we can do differently, how we can do better, so we not only end up as a state that is innovative in serving in the human services delivery, but is also known as a leader in being efficient and much more cost-effective as well. You know, in that light, I mean, a few things I want to look at, and I'm not here with, with answers, and I think many of you have expertise that I certainly want to draw on and I will learn about. But I do want to look at for the accountability and transparency that we need more of in our healthcare contracting. So I'm going to take a hard look at our healthcare contracting. I want to look at our state-operated services and say, how can we better integrate these with the healthcare delivery system to better serve our citizens? You know, where we can, I think we do need to streamline regulation. I mean, DHS regulates, I think, 23,000 providers. You know, I want to take a look at that system. I want to also, where we can, think about, you know, how we incentivize people to take more personal responsibility, you know, for our health care. I think we have to be careful how we do that when we're talking about vulnerable populations, what works in the private sector, what works, you know, with kind of for someone like me, a kind of middle-class mom of four is going to be different than some of the vulnerable citizens that we serve. But I think that we all need to think to look at our systems to see where that can be done. I do think we need to look at all of this kind of with the overarching, some would say looking forward to, some would say looming. We want to stop it. The overarching fact of federal reform that is out there. I think that there are many things that federal health reform offers to the state, and I think we need to be cognizant of that. On the other hand, I do not want to go into federal reform, and I know there are many debates about whether federal reform is wise or not, but that is the law right now. And I certainly want to avoid having Minnesota have federal reform thrust upon it in a cookie-cutter federal way. I want us to do this in a way that works for Minnesota. We have long been an innovator. And I think we should continue to look at our citizens and try and serve them in the best way possible, taking advantage of federal dollars wherever we can to do that, but doing it in our own way. So, Senator, I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I didn't mean this as here's my whole agenda. This is day four. I just found the Capitol. But I certainly am willing to answer questions now or later. And certainly, if you all want to meet with many of you, and I hope you'll call me and we can set up those meetings.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, welcome to the Capitol. It's good to see you here. I just want you to be aware of one concern in my district. You know, we just heard this morning about the award of this federal grant to study and do surveillance about autism in the Somali community. And so that's a good thing. But we know, even without having this study done, that there is a higher prevalence of autism in the Somali community than one would normally expect to find. And yet, my understanding is within the Department of Human Services, there are only really a handful of Somali children that have received waivers. And so I just want you to be aware of that concern, and perhaps someplace along the way in the work that you're doing, you can try and find out if there should be more outreach done or if there should be more information provided so that people with autistic children in the Somali community would have better understanding how they can get appropriate services.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, thank you for bringing that to my attention. I did hear of the award this morning, and I will take a look at that.
Are there any other questions that committee members have at this point? Well, seeing none, Commissioner, again, we appreciate very much your taking the time from your busy schedule and your relatively recent tenure in the department. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to working with you and others in your department. And you are welcome to stay if you wish to observe the rest of the hearing, or if you have other more pressing things, you certainly don't need to. But we are thankful and grateful for your appearance here. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you to the committee.
All right. Thank you. Next, we'd like to hear from the new commissioner of the Department of Human Services. I'm sorry, Department of Health. Did I get that wrong? Dr. Ellinger, please. Dr. Ellinger, Commissioner, we again appreciate your taking the time today. Thanks for being here, and would extend the same invitation to you to let us know anything you would like about your background or your interests or what you see is in the future for the department. But thanks for being here today.
Senator Hand, members of the committee, thank you for this invitation. Commissioner Jessen has a day on me. This is my third day on the job, and it is one that my definition of a good job is one that is doing important things, has a steep learning curve, and is fun. I know two of those three things are part of this job. I'm hoping that the fun part is also there. Certainly, the department does some great work in collaboration with lots of folks in the governor's office and in the legislature. And certainly the learning curve is going to be very steep in the next few weeks and months as we look at all of the issues that are facing the state of Minnesota and its people. I'm going to give just a little bit of background of how I got to this point, because I think it is instructive in terms of how I look at the world. I hate to admit it, I'm originally from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I did shovel Bart Starr's driveway, and I went to a school that had old Packer equipment that we used, so I do have some allegiances to the Packers, but I've lived in Minnesota 30 years, and I have two daughters who are avid Viking fans, so it adds to some fun within the family. I'm also a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, which caused me some concerns when I was employed by the University of Minnesota for 16 years. So I'm comfortable with dealing with conflict and differences of opinion. So I think that is going to do me well, I think, in the the months ahead. But when I went into medicine, my plan was to be a general practitioner in a rural community. So I did my own kind of family medicine residency by doing internal medicine and pediatrics. And I'm boarded in internal medicine and pediatrics. And I practiced general medicine in rural Montana for a couple of years. And it's there that I realized that I could be seeing 40 to 60 patients per day, and yet I really wouldn't have a huge impact on the health of those little communities without some other support from, at that point, I didn't know what, but come to find later, the public health sector, that physicians working by themselves, treating individuals, cannot really change the influence of tobacco use or alcohol use or violence or environmental concerns by themselves, so that there needed to be a partnership. So because of that, I went and got a master's in public health at the University of North Carolina, still anticipating to go back into a rural community. So actually my research at the University of North Carolina was how to use healthcare resources in a rural community. But because I had dragged my wife around the country for many years, she wanted to go back to school, so she chose to come to the University of Minnesota and get a PhD in physical education. And while I was here, I got a job with the Minneapolis Health Department and worked for the Minneapolis Health Department for 15 years, doing both medical care and the public health services for the city of Minneapolis. And there I realized the power of integrating medicine and public health and involving the community in the decisions about their health. And that really prompted me to learn more about how to engage communities, how to work with the private sector and the public health sector in really enhancing communities. And for 15 years, I did that. When Minneapolis, and I probably would have still been there except the Minneapolis Health Department during the prepaid medical assistance program, got out of the clinical care business, I looked around to see where else we could find a place that did both medicine and public health, and that was Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota. So I spent 16 years as the director of Boynton Health Service. Again, seeing the power of merging medicine and public health for a defined community, but also as the state land grant institution, realized that organizations and that a statewide approach to some of these issues are really important, that are beyond what can be done just by local jurisdictions. So when the opportunity to come to the state health department arose, it became very intriguing because this is an organization that has a statewide impact, regional impact, and actually national impact because of the reputation of the department, as an opportunity to work with other agencies within state government and other organizations within the state to really bring together that medicine and public health approach that I think is really beneficial to the state. So I come with that agenda to try to bring medicine and public health together using a public health approach in areas where it hasn't been used before. Certainly bringing the public health approach to health care reform, because I think any kind of health care reform has to be for the benefit of the entire population. Working with other agencies, certainly with DHS and Commerce on those, but also maintaining the stature that the Minnesota Department of Health has in this state and in the country as a premier public health organization. Also, I bring with my background in local public health the need or the desire to really work closely with the local CHS agencies, which again in this state are a model for the country, and that's where the interactions really work. So for example, the autism in the Somali community, working with the local health departments on addressing those issues along with the state, I see as a really important approach to dealing with the issues that face us. So my approach is one of maintaining the quality of MDH, getting involved in healthcare reform discussions so that we have a public health approach, merging medicine and public health, and working with the local CHS agencies, local communities, and local providers of both public health and medical care to see if we can't develop a model system here in the state of Minnesota that really benefits all. And certainly I will be coming before you periodically. I have good staff at the Minnesota Department of Health who are willing to provide you technical assistance whenever that is needed. So please feel free to ask for help and information when you need that. So with that, I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Ellinger, I look forward to working with you in your new role. I wanted, again, just to speak a little bit about this grant. And really, you know, Idi Abdul practically got this grant for us single-handedly. And, you know, as a parent of an autistic child and a person from Somalia, it's really quite remarkable what she has done. And, you know, I just want to say that I think in the future I'm hoping that the Department of Health will be more aggressive on these issues and provide more support for getting these kind of funds so that someone in the community doesn't have to perform such heroic tasks.
Commissioner.
Senator Hand, Senator Berglund. The definition of public health that the Institute of Medicine has is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. It doesn't say anything about any profession or any organization is what we as a society do. And I think the issue of autism is one that demonstrates how that goes. People bring forward issues. Agencies bring forward issues. We look at the data. I think this grant coming that from CDC and NIH, an excellent way of actually analyzing what's going on to get some solid data so that we can generate programs and policies that specifically address the issue and are effective. So I look forward to meeting with you and your constituent about this issue. Our staff have talked about this. It is an issue that we will address in the most effective way, using good data collection, using the resources that are available so that we can address this problem in an effective way.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Ellinger, it's great to see you here. I was working at the City of Minneapolis when you were the last time as well, and know all the good work that you did there. And it followed your career at Boynton as well. So I look forward. I think everybody in the committee will be pleased with the idea of having a public health related person running the health department. It's a very good day.
Any other questions from the committee? Well, Commissioner, again, we appreciate your willingness to come on relatively short notice and relatively new into your tenure, and we look forward to working with you and others in your department as we take on the task of trying to balance the state's budget, and we appreciate very much your service and your willingness to be here today.
And thank you for the opportunity to come and visit with you for a little bit. I look forward to our future meetings.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Next, we want to invite to return Ms. Miner and Dr. Golden to continue the presentation that they began last week. And do you need some visual aid support here? I can't recall if you had that last time or not. Do we need to take a time out and put something together here for?
Mr. Chair, we do have a PowerPoint, although it is my understanding that you have the slides. So certainly whatever is more convenient for the committee, I think we're flexible with regard to that.
Well, thank you. And committee members, if you're all okay with not taking time to set up the visual portion, we can refer to the slides in your handout, if that's all right. And so we will turn it over to you. Go ahead. Thank you.
Darcy Miner is unable to be here at this time, so I will do the presentation for her. My name is Irene Goldman.
I'm sorry, Irene
Goldman.
Could you pull the microphone just a little closer? Appreciate it.
G-O-L-D-M-A-N. And I'm the manager of the section that licenses HMOs. And I've been with the department for 20 years. So, we license and regulate HMOs. Health maintenance organizations.
Even
in
closer, please. We can't hear.
Can't hear.
Just bring it right up close.
Okay, we license HMOs in Minnesota. We have currently 8 HMOs. We regulate them for a number of things, specifically financial solvency, which is very important, and quality assurance. So we're looking at both aspects of that. For financial solvency, we have been contracting with the Minnesota Department of Commerce to do this for us because of their expertise. And what they do for us is they review the annual financial reports that HMOs file. They also review and analyze the quarterly reports that are filed. And they conduct a full financial examination every 3 years or more often if needed. Usually 3 years is enough. So through their ongoing analysis and oversight, they let us know how the HMOs are doing and if there are any concerns. And if there are any, they recommend what we might want to do about it because we still retain the authority to license and take action. We also regulate for quality. We oversee quality. We do this within our department. And we basically we go out every 3 years and we do a full quality assurance examination of each HMO. And we review for the HMO's internal quality assurance program, which also includes the way they oversee their delegates. For instance, they'll typically contract with someone to manage the pharmacy benefit to set up a network to do chiropractic care and other things. So that's part of their quality program is to oversee this. We also look at utilization review to see how they're making those determinations of medical necessity and appeals and everything else under Minnesota Chapter 62M. We look at how they're doing their own internal complaint and appeal processes. And we look to see network adequacy, which is who's in the network, where they're located, how long does it take people to get appointments. We also have the authority to investigate complaints filed with us by HMO enrollees, and that's another way of overseeing quality, to see what we find in terms of complaint investigation. We also regulate county-based purchasing, which is a system that allows counties or groups of counties to set up health plans for people in the public programs. We currently have three county-based purchasing entities in Minnesota. They're not licensed, but they are subject to the same statutes as apply to HMOs in terms of financial solvency and quality assurance. So we look at those as well, and we also, through a contract with the Department of Human Services, look at some additional requirements that apply to county-based purchasing and the public plans only as opposed to the commercial plans. And basically, that's what we do.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Goldman? Dr. Goldman.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the Division Director for the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, there are a number of slides that it is helpful to see. I'm going to be starting on the slide that has overview at the top and its sources of healthcare coverage in Minnesota. The Department of Health has a number of programs that collect and analyze information about the healthcare market in Minnesota. One of those programs is our health economics program, which collects and analyzes information related to healthcare access, costs, quality, and utilization. One of the biggest users of our work are policymakers such as yourself, who are very interested in understanding Minnesota's healthcare market and understanding how changes in policy might impact that market. What I'm going to be talking about today is a little bit about how Minnesotans receive their healthcare coverage. Going to talk a little bit about that as well in terms of spending, both of the source of those funds and where the spending is going, some of the trends that we see in healthcare spending, as well as some of the projections that we have made for the future. Taking a look at the next slide, the distribution of coverage. So this is based on 2009 data. From the census, there are about 5.3 million Minnesotans, and with 63.7% of those Minnesotans receive their coverage through private health insurance. About 25.3% of Minnesotans have coverage through fully insured insurance products, and they would be covered by the regulatory activities that you heard last time from Commissioner Munson-Ragala, as well as from Ms. Goldman today. Another 38.4% of Minnesotans receive their coverage through self-insured products and are not subject to the same state regulations. 27.3% of Minnesotans have public coverage, with 14.7% of those in Medicare and 12% in state public programs, and another 0.5% is in MCHA, Minnesota's high-risk pool. The remaining 9% of Minnesotans are uninsured. That's approximately 480,000 individuals. Approximately 85,000 of those are kids. Taking a look at the next slide, you have an opportunity to see how Minnesotans' health insurance coverage has changed over the past decade. I think one thing to note that it's important to understand is that 1999 was really the high watermark for Minnesota with regard to insurance coverage. That was the year that Minnesota had the lowest uninsured rate at 5.4%. Since 1999, what we have seen as trends in the private coverage, we have seen coverage decline from 72.2% down to our most recent numbers of 63.7%. At the same time, public coverage has grown from 22.4% to 27.3%. The largest portion of that increase came in the form of medical assistance, although there is also clearly an increase in Medicare, which reflects the graying and aging of our population as well. A couple of things that I would like to just also point out about this particular table is that although Minnesota Care has been reasonably consistent over the time period that has been shown in this table, it is worth noting that the enrollment has increased markedly in 2010, and that really reflects the tough economic conditions that we are facing here in Minnesota. Additionally, in 2009, the uninsured rate has reached the highest share of the population since the Department of Health has begun measuring this data. Much of the increase in the number of uninsured is a direct result of the economic downturn and the shock to the labor market. You have a number of people who have lost coverage as a result of losing their job. Many people are working fewer hours and no longer eligible for their employer-sponsored coverage, as well as employees who are just finding it more difficult to cover their portion of the insurance. Taking a look at the next slide, this is specifically looking at the private insurance market. One way to think about that market is to segment it by size. I think you heard a little bit about that from the brokers in your last hearing. What you see is that there's the large group market, which is for groups of 51-plus individuals. Right now, about 51.6% of Minnesotans are receiving coverage through that type of market. The small group market, which is for individuals in groups of 2 to 50, about 7.3% of Minnesotans are receiving coverage through that. That has been a slow decline over the past decade. And the individual market is reasonably steady. It is currently at 4.8%. Taking a look at the next slide, another way to think about the healthcare market as opposed to looking at where individuals are getting coverage is to look at the market by spending. In our most recent data, which is the 2008 data, total overall healthcare spending in Minnesota is $35.1 billion. What this chart does is it takes a look at who spent that money, and in order of size, about 42.5% of that was through the private health insurance market. Another 18.4% was through medical assistance. Medicare was 16.7%. 12.9% came out of pocket, so that is spending that is directly coming from the enrollee or the patients from their own pockets, obviously. 6.8% was from other public sources. That would include Minnesota Care, GAMC, and MCHA. And another 2.7% was from other private sources, which would be such activities as workers' comp or auto. Taking a look at the next slide, again, this is taking a look at the total spending of $35.1 billion and taking a look at what types of services those dollars are being spent on. The largest single category of expense is hospital services, which represents 32.6% of spending. That's followed by 21.5% for physician services. Another 15% is going for long-term care, and in this chart would also include home health care. The next largest category is 14.1% on other spending. This would include such things as chemical dependency, mental health, durable medical, and non-medical healthcare spending. Prescription drugs is at about 9.6%, dental 3.9%, and another 3.4% on other professional services. The next slide that you see, again, instead of looking at the total market, is really looking at the private sector healthcare spending. And it compares where we are on healthcare spending with a number of other important private sector indicators. I think what you will see in this slide is that healthcare costs are growing at an unsustainable rate and that healthcare is becoming increasingly unaffordable. You probably don't have color slides, which would have been helpful with the chart. But let me the very top line of the chart, what that shows is growth in healthcare spending, excluding the enrollees out of pocket. So what you're seeing on the very top line is the increase between 2000 and 2009 of the private healthcare spending. The next line down shows the growth in Minnesota's economy. The kind of the next line down that's there with the triangles is shows the increase in per capita income. The next line down would show the increase in wages. And finally, the bottom line shows the increase in inflation. And so again, what this chart is showing is that healthcare costs are growing substantially faster than income and wages. And as a result, healthcare and in healthcare coverage is becoming increasingly more unaffordable within the private sector. Taking a look at the next slide, what this shows...
Dr. Golden, can I interrupt for 1 second? And Senator Nino, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a question on that slide. Is the baseline 1999... In 2000, we're seeing there that percentage. It looks like healthcare costs is roughly about 10%. Is that from 1999 to 2000, there was a 10% increase? Just for clarity's sake, I was wanting to understand that slide.
Do you know?
So this is you're asking the increase from 1999 to 2000?
Well, you said the increase there was from 2000 to 2009, but the year 2000 is starting out at something other than zero. So I'm just wondering if 1999 was the baseline. And if
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nienau, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Burgum.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Golden, if you look at this chart and you look at the line that marks the rate of inflation on it, the one with the biggest square boxes, I guess it would be, would it be a fair assumption for people to assume that the administrative costs of health plans and insurance companies would be trending about at the same rate of general inflation?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I'm not sure that that is an accurate statement. My recollection of it off the top of my head is that it has been reasonably constant as a percentage.
I understand that. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Golden, I'm not asking you what it has been. I'm asking you if it would be a fair assumption to assume that it should be, it should be about the same rate of inflation. I mean, after all, buying a computer, paying for postage, buying secretarial services, those administrative services are not increasing faster in the healthcare arena than they are in the rest of the economy, are they?
Dr. Gold?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, no, I don't believe that they are.
And then, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Golden, if you look at the line about healthcare costs, when we talk about loss ratios and we talk about how much administrative costs are allowed in the healthcare sector, it is usually pegged to the rate of inflation because it's usually pegged to a percentage of total revenues. Is that not correct?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I think generally correct. I think that the administrative expenses generally to total expenditures as opposed to revenue, but yes.
Well, the expenditures are based on the revenue, are they not?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, one would hope that there's a relationship between them.
So, Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Berglund,
my only point here is that, you know, let's just say for the purpose of this discussion that let's just say we assume that the federal law and past state law allows 20% administrative costs. That 20% grows by the amount of healthcare spending because it's a percentage of the total spending. And so for us to just assume that the administrative costs should be going up as fast as the other health care costs, I think, is problematic.
And Senator Berglund, I appreciate your point, and it might be useful at some time to have some of the insurers to talk a little bit about administrative costs, maybe provide us some information about that. My own understanding is that I don't believe that the administrative costs are planned to grow. I think what they're trying to do is account for certain expenses, and I think it might be useful for us to understand what those expenses are and take a look at just what the trend has been. But I don't believe that there is an expectation that they should grow automatically, to your point.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm not saying that every plan has high administrative costs, but I know there are some that do, and I think it's important for us to understand, because a lot of times people will just take it on face value. Oh, well, if it's 10%, that's a reasonable amount. But if it's 10% of something that's growing by 15%.
Sure. Well, it's a good question, and what I'd like to do is see if we can get an answer, ask some of our resources in the insurance industry to provide the committee with some information about administrative costs. Perhaps would be helpful to see what makes up those costs and just what the trends have been, and we'll look at getting that information perhaps by our next meeting, and we can talk about that at that point. And
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Benson.
Just a quick point. In highly regulated industries, inflation is not necessarily an indication as a cost driver. And so what we would need to do is, as you said, understand what the true cost drivers are in private health insurance. That might be regulation. That might be changes in the population that they're serving. And so before we go forward with the assumption that inflation is the best indicator of how to control our administrative costs, I think it would be prudent to step back. Well, look perhaps at the SIC code and cost drivers related to that industry.
And Senator Benson, I appreciate your point. I can only tell you from my experience working in the private sector, when we were dealing with vendors and other folks that would come to our business and propose changes in contracts or changes in relationships that we had with them, and if they included a cost in their proposal that was inflation, called inflation, that was never acceptable to us. We always would want to know, what does that mean? What are the things you're putting into that category, and why are they going up? And there are some things, obviously, that do go up that are beyond the control of a business or an organization. We appreciate that. But it is helpful to understand what those things are, and I think part of the work of the committee this year will be to try to understand the cost drivers in all the areas of healthcare provision. I think we should understand those things, and to the extent that they are things that could be addressed, we will, I hope, do the best we can to address them. But thank you for raising the issue, and we'll seek some further information from the insurers about their administrative costs. Senator Lori.
You know, I think maybe just to add a little bit of clarity, what I heard Senator Berglund asking is, on this slide 13, with the trends in private health care costs, should the cost of administration of the HMOs and whatnot follow that health care cost trend line that goes up like this, or should it follow the inflation line that goes a little bit more like this? I mean, which is the more reasonable? And I think it was more a question to the sure. Department of Health, and one that is open for debate, and we can certainly talk about it. But it is a very legitimate question, because I think that with the answer that it has been following this trend line, that's a little, you know, it's worthy of asking the question, should it follow that highly inflationary trend line, or should it follow one more akin with the rest of the economy? And so it is out there as a question.
Senator Lori, I appreciate you. I agree, it's a good question, and Senator Berglund, it is a good question. I think we need to get some information, and we will go to the source and ask those folks to provide us with information about the trends in administrative costs. But thank you for raising that point. Dr. Cole.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I am currently on the slide that has a number of bar charts there. And as you might recall, in the last slide that had shown how private sector costs have increased in relation to a number of other private sector indicators, what that chart excluded was actually the enrollees out of pocket. What this slide is doing is it's taking a closer look at the private sector.
Mr.
And this
Chairman,
time
excuse me. Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could have Dr. Golden tell us. I'm not sure which slide he's on.
And thank you.
There,
right.
There's a number in the lower right-hand corner. Maybe you could identify it that way, please.
Dr. Golden, I think you're on slide 14. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So Senator Newman and others in the committee were on looking at slide 14, the bar chart showing a trend from 1999 to 2009. Continue, Doctor.
And so what this particular chart is focusing on is, again, private sector healthcare costs, but this time it is also including not only those portions of the costs that are paid through coverage, but is also paid through the enrollees portion. And so what you see in this chart in what is the bottom portion, I assume it's probably the darker gray on your copies, is that this portion of the graph is the health plan costs, and you can see that those have been rising steadily over time and have more than doubled from 1999 to 2009. These increasing costs explain the consistent increase that we see in premiums. Additionally, the top portion, which I assume is probably the light gray portion in your slides, shows the increase in the enrollees' out-of-pocket spending. And the enrollees' annual share of their cost has increased from $186 on average in 1999 to $731 in 2009. That's an increase percentage-wise from 10% to 16%. And so, again, I think what we are starting to see with this slide is that not only are premiums increasing, making health care coverage more expensive and less affordable, but additionally, more of the cost is also being shifted to enrollees, also adding to the pressure, making health care less affordable overall.
And Dr. Golden, just for my information, the change that you're describing here, is it correct to assume that what this reflects is the increased cost drivers, that people are using more health care, that as we age in population, as the demographics shift, that costs to individuals tend to be higher because we do more things and do more expensive things? Is that a part of what you're describing here, that this is a trend we're on that's due to the changes in the population? Is that part of the what the graph is telling us?
Mr. Chair, I think that the graph has a combination of two major components. One would be price increases as well as utilization increases. So total dollars expended, of course, would be the amount of utilization multiplied by the price. In this case, the chart is not breaking out which components of the overall increase in spending might be a result of utilization increases versus price increases. But I do think what the chart is trying to demonstrate is that not only are the premiums and the health plan costs going up, but additionally, globally, what you see is more of the costs are also being shifted on to the enrollees, which also adds added pressure to the affordability.
Senator Nino, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This chart is for the fully insured private market. Is there similar information for public plans?
Dr. Golden.
Well, certainly we have costs with regard to that. I think some of the cost sharing within many of the public programs is quite modest. But we certainly would have we'd have information about the growth of expenditures per capita in public programs as well.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Nino. And Senator Berglin.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Golden, wouldn't it be fair to say that our public programs have a much higher risk population that we provide health insurance for than the private market does?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglin, I believe that would be an accurate statement.
So I just wanted to point that out and bring that up because it's a little bit erroneous then to compare the inflation within the private sector to the inflation that might be going on or the utilization that might be going on in the public programs.
And Senator Berglin, I think that's a good point, and I think we perhaps need to get some additional information about the demographics of the people who are enrolled in the plans. But I think most of us would suspect that the insurance that we're providing the public care system is probably for individuals that have some more dramatic needs, and it could be more costly. But I think, too, and we may need to look for some information as well, From what I have read in the last couple of months about the private insurance market, there is also a significant part of the increase in costs that's attributed to the subsidy of the public by the private payers in the public system. As you look at the underpayment by the public system in rates and so forth, and the providers then having to seek to make up their cost differences by charging higher premiums in the private pay market. I'm not sure exactly what that percentage is, but I would imagine that that is also contributing to some of the upward pressure in this graph. So I think we're beginning to get into some of the things that are problematic in our structure and our system that we're going to have to wrestle with as we go forward in the budget and look at ways to do this differently. But certainly we look at the trend and we look at the future, and it's going to be a challenge to make this work. But I appreciate the point, Senator Berglund. Dr. Golden.
I am on the slide that would be 15. I don't know if it has the little number. It starts historical and projected healthcare spending in Minnesota. This final slide is from a new annual report that the legislature required us to start in 2010. And the purpose of the report is really to evaluate over time the healthcare reforms that were passed in the 2008 legislative session. And so what this chart is doing is, if you look at the right side of the chart, it shows projected healthcare spending in the absence of any state healthcare reforms. And it's ultimately intended over time to compare that projected spending with actual spendings with the 2008 reforms in place. And so because this is the very first time we have been required to do this, and because we are generally on a two-year lag for good cost data, what this is really looking at is at the very start of where we were when the 2008 health reforms were passed. And so again, staying on the right side of the chart, what the top line in this chart shows is that in the absence of any reforms, we project that the 2008 healthcare spending levels will grow from $35.1 billion in 2008 to $69.6 billion in 2018. And that would represent an average annual growth rate of approximately 7.1%. The lower line in that chart also shows the projected growth in healthcare spending with Medicare and long-term care subtracted out. Again, in the absence of any reforms, we project that healthcare spending would grow from $24.5 billion to $49 billion in 2018. Again, that's taking out Medicare and long-term care. Even if you take that out, you still see an average annual growth rate of 7.2%. What you see on the left side of the chart is our historical data that looks at actual spending. Over time, what you would expect to see in this chart is where the projections are and allow you to compare them with the actual. And again, this was passed in 2008 to try to evaluate some of those particular reforms.
Thank you.
And then the final slide, Mr. Chair, committee members, has contact information for us at the department. We have a great deal of information about the market that we would be more than happy to work with you and the committee in any way that might help you in the task ahead.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Golden, quick question about your chart 15 again. Since 2008, there's been the recession, which I think did bring down some medical spending. Some are these projections the ones you made in 2008, or are these the current numbers? And were they, are they lower because of the recession or because of anything else than not? Or is it, did your numbers change because of the recession or not?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, yes, these numbers do reflect where we are starting to see how the recession and the impact in Minnesota. So the projected numbers are intended to take into account various factors that are outside of the state. So downturn in economy, improvement in economy, various things like that. What aren't reflected in these, because these were put out in June of 2010, these don't reflect any of the external changes as a result of federal health reform.
Senator
Mr. Martin. Chair, just to follow up on that, though, so in other words, the numbers you have here are after the prior to federal health reform and excluding state reforms, but these are after the, even though it's going up that steep level, that's after the recession is factored in.
Dr. Gold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, yes, that is correct. We worked with the actuaries in what would have been the spring of last year to take that into account.
You know,
I think one of the questions that might be there is to what degree is Minnesota either lagging or ahead with regard to economic downturn. So very well in our next projections might need to further account for the economic downturn.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Everything I am looking at is brand new to me, so please excuse me if I ask questions that are foolish or seem uninformed. But Dr. Golden, am I correct that the Department of Health is responsible for HMO regulation and oversight, and the Department of Commerce is responsible for the same thing in terms of private insurance companies, private health insurance companies? And the follow-up, assuming I'm correct, has there ever been any discussion as to why we have two different agencies overseeing the same topic, and is there any discussion as to maybe combining them to better serve the people in Minnesota?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, I think there are a couple of things that I would like to just say. The first thing is perhaps you just misspoke. The HMO is a type of private sector health insurance. So what it is correct that the Department of Health has regulatory responsibility for the HMOs, which is a particular type of health insurance within Minnesota. They are required to be nonprofit entities and the like. The Department of Commerce is responsible for what would be the other forms of insurance, primarily some of the indemnity insurance associated with that. There are probably members of this committee who could provide you a better historical explanation for the division between those responsibilities. But I suspect that it has quite a lot to do with the history behind HMOs, health maintenance organizations. So traditionally, indemnity insurance has been simply a paying mechanism. And if you look in the 70s, when HMOs were really starting to come into the fore, they were really about health maintenance and the management of care as well. So while I think what Commerce has traditionally had for their programs and their insurers has been more of a payment financing mechanism, the idea, I think, originally behind HMOs has been that they would be much more involved in helping to manage the overall care. And so when you look at the regulation at Commerce, they certainly are specialized in looking at financial solvency and a number of the financial issues. And in fact, as Ms. Goldman was saying, we actually contract with the Department of Commerce to do all of our financial regulatory activities on our behalf. What is still at the department is looking at a number of other issues around quality, around network adequacy, and some of those types of issues. So I think that is probably a better perhaps the explanation for the difference.
And Senator Nino, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two questions, but they both relate to this slide. In looking at the right half in the projected spending with a 7.1% annual rate, I think it's fair to say that some of that would be a result of population growth. Some of that would be a part of demographic changes, aging population needing more health care services, et cetera. And some of that would be, for lack of a better term, just health care inflation. Is there any way to break that apart at all? Is that data available at that level or no?
Dr. Gold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nienau, you know, I don't think we have it broken down quite to that level. I'm we tend to have more aggregate data about the market. And so I don't think that would be available.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, my second question.
Senator Nino.
The right half of that chart is a projection excluding the anticipated impact of the 2008 reform. Is there a chart or is there data that does include that reform? Is that available?
Dr. Gold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, I think that's exactly what this chart will eventually become. And so, again, if you think about by the time the private sector has to close up their books, we collect the data, we analyze it, so we are on approximately a two-year lag. This chart was originally put together in June of last year. And so because the bill was passed in 2008, our very first year does not have an overlap between the projected and actual. What you will see in future years is that the actual will start to line up either above or below the projected.
Thank you. Dr. Golden, I had a question. I wanted to go back to your earlier slide, number 9, talking about the trend in the insurance coverage and the differences between the public and the private providers of insurance. And generally, as I recall, you're pointing out here that there is growth and increased share in the public market and a declining share in the private market. And you also talked about the uninsured rate rising, which you, I think, attributed to perhaps dislocation as part of economic changes and people perhaps not being able to stay employed and getting insurance through their employer. The self-insured number, is that not the number that reflects where the employer groups are categorized in this chart?
Mr. Chair, the self-insured would reflect the large employer groups. Generally, small employers would tend to be more in the fully insured market. So, yes, the large employer groups.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Cole. I'm just looking at those percentages really haven't changed in that self-insured market. So to the extent that there are changes in the uninsured, it probably would then be related to the insurance being covered in this what is called the fully insured or possibly in the public programs is accounting for the higher rate. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there are probably a couple of things that are going on within the table. So I think one of the things that's going on within the table is you are seeing a slow but steady shift from fully insured products into the self-insured products. So I think you're seeing more and more employers who maybe previously were in the fully insured market, more of them are now in the self-insured market. I think some of the unemployment that, I'm sorry, I misspoke, some of the increase in the uninsurance that we are seeing is really related to people's ability to take up their coverage from an employer. So one of the things that we do every 2 years is we do a large survey of Minnesotans, about 12,000 Minnesotans, to take a look at all sorts of things about insurance coverage. And one of the things that we take a look at is our employers offering coverage. And what we have seen over time is that the offer rates, the rates, the percentage that are offering coverage has been reasonably stable. What has seemingly decreased somewhat is what we would call the take-up rate. And the take-up rate is if my employer is offering coverage, am I taking that up? And I think that there are kind of two big reasons for a decrease in the take-up rate. The first is people are working fewer hours and may no longer be eligible for what their employer is offering. The other issue I think affecting take-up rate is just the cost. So even though my employer might be offering coverage, to the degree that I have to pay for portions of that or the out-of-pocket, it might still be unaffordable to me. And so although you do see self-insured being stable, I think there are a couple of different issues impacting those numbers.
Okay. Thank you for that. One other question on this table, Doctor. The trend is showing, 9% growth in the public portion of the market and about the same percentage decline in the private. And I would ask you to comment on that. Do you see that as a continuing trend, that there will be a shift to larger percentage of the population in the publicly insured market and a decline in the private market? Do you see this as a troubling trend? In other words, should we be working to find ways to expand the coverage in the private market, or should we be working to expand the coverage in the public market? Do you have any comment on that trend for us, what you see in the future with that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the first thing I would say is I think some of the increase that we are seeing in the public programs is probably a direct result of the economic downturn. So to the degree that people might be unemployed, to the degree that they might have less income, they would tend to be more eligible either for medical assistance or MinnesotaCare. So I think part of the increase is a direct result of the economic downturn. I think with regard to the overall issue, I think that clearly one of the goals of the state of Minnesota for some time has been to reduce the number of uninsured. And I think that we have deployed a number of programs in an attempt to do that, both to make private sector coverage more affordable by reducing overall health care costs, paying for value as opposed to volume. And so I think from my perspective, the goal still remains to get as much coverage as possible. And I think that ultimately that's going to need to be done across the board. And probably the number one thing to do to be able to get that would be to get costs under control and make health care more affordable and not growing at an unsustainable rate.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for your willingness to come back and take up our discussion we had last week. We appreciate it. And thank you, Ms. Goldman, for filling in and for your presentation as well. And members, I apologize a little bit for the disjointed flow of the agenda today, but we're trying to stay on track as best we can, and I want to continue and invite Mr. Albrecht, our analyst, to take us back to the discussion we were having last week about the structure of the budget. And I believe you should have in your packets the handout, the slides that you were working from before. The members have those in your packet? There were the slide set that we were working off of. One other thing I want to draw to your attention, members, in your packet, you'll also see there were some questions asked. The department has sent us a response for. You should have a four-page packet that has responses to questions about MA optional and mandatory expansion. And so we can take a look at that, too, if you'd like. But they forwarded that to us as well. Do members have the packets available? And so, Mr. Albrecht, can you tell us where we were in our presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to orient ourselves back to where we finished up last week, if you go to page 52, there is a slide that describes the major program areas in the Department of Health. There are four of them: community and family health promotion, policy quality and compliance, health protection, and administrative support. We had finished the first one, and we're just moving into the second one, and that begins on page 57. So this is what is called the policy quality and compliance area of the Department of Health, and the slide on page 57 shows you the various funds that program receives funding through. Obviously, the biggest one there is the Merck Fund, 54%, $155 million. For this area, a very small proportion, 8%, comes from the general fund. And then other relatively small portions from the various other funds shown on that chart. Moving on to page 58, one of the areas of activity in this program area is compliance monitoring, and under that is Medicaid surveys and reviews. This is oversight and activities to ensure that providers and facilities are meeting the standards set forth in law and those sorts of activities. The general fund funding for this activity is about $5.7 million. another area of activity is overseeing health professionals and health facilities. There is money spent regulating facilities that serve vulnerable adults. That's through the state government special revenue fund. It's about $5.2 million. Birth centers is a relatively new activity. That's about $14,000. The department regulates home care and assisted living facilities and providers. That's about $2.7 million from the state government special revenue fund. They regulate the managed care systems. That's about $2.9 million from the state government special revenue fund. And they also do health care facility licensing and certification. That's about $20 million, and that funding is through the special revenue fund. The next slide on page 59 has a variety of activities under the health policy area. The health statistics area conducts analysis of vital statistics data and produces annual reports on a statewide and county basis. And they also do reporting on health disparities in communities of color. That is about $2.5 million in general fund money. The state registrar is where you get your birth certificates and death certificates and such. They also do marriage licenses and divorce records, and they run the father's adoption registry. It's funded largely by fees that you pay to do those things, and it's about $7 million out of the state government special revenue fund. The healthcare transformation activity is where the work to implement the 2007 healthcare transformation task force activities goes forward. That developed a statewide action plan for transforming the healthcare system to improve affordability, quality access, and the health status of Minnesotans. It's funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund, and it's about $6.2 million. You just heard Dr. Golden talking about a variety of factors in healthcare economics, so you have a sense of what goes on there. That's also funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund largely. It's $3.2 million. There is an Office of Rural Health. It's actually called the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. Promotes access to quality health care for rural and underserved urban Minnesotans. And it also supports efforts to accelerate the adoption and use of the electronic health records and health information technology, including telehealth. That activity is funded through the Healthcare Access Fund, and it's about $3.5 million. The department administers a variety of loan forgiveness programs for various health professions. It's funded out of the general fund and the Healthcare Access Fund for a total of about $1.8 million. And the last activity there that I highlighted was the Merck Fund, and you saw its proportion earlier. The next program area at the Department of Health is health protection, and this slide on page 60 shows you that the vast majority of that money comes from the federal government, 56% of it, or $124.4 million. And after that, the next largest source is the state government special revenue fund. On page 61 are some of the things that are overseen in this area. There are a variety of inspections and licensing and regulations that are done. Drinking water takes a large amount of the money in this area. It's about $22 million divided up mostly between the state government special revenue fund and the federal fund. These other groups, the food, beverages, and lodging, hospitality, and such, these are folks who all pay fees to the department for their licensing, and the department in turn uses that money to administer the activities that oversee them, including the swimming pools and well management, X-ray equipment, and radioactive materials. They range from, you know, the food and beverage area being about $10 million. Swimming pools, I believe that's a relatively new activity, about $1.3 million. Well management, about $7.1 million. I'm going to try and get through all of these slides by the time we finish at noon, so if I go a little too fast, just let me know after the committee if you want to get more information on any of these things. I'd be happy to sit down with you and talk about them. under the health protection area also are these activities related to infectious disease epidemiology, prevention, and control. They do surveillance and outbreak investigation for acute diseases, similar activities for AIDS programs and community prevention. The department does coordination and distribution for immunizations and vaccinations. That's largely funded by the federal government. It's about $10.6 million with a small $30,000 from this special revenue fund. There is tuberculosis monitoring. That's funded by the federal government, about $2 million. Hepatitis monitoring, also funded by the federal government, about $1.6 million. Monitoring for emerging infections is also funded by the federal government for about $6.8 million. Still in the health protection area, the public health laboratory section does all of those things listed there. They are all funded either through the state government special revenue fund or the federal fund. The bioterrorism lab is all federal money. It's $8.6 million. The emerging infections lab is also all federal money, about $5.2 million. That newborn screening activity is all funded through the state government special revenue fund, and that is about $13.8 million. Also in this area is page 64, the Office of Emergency Preparedness, which receives about $7.5 million in federal money. The pandemic flu preparedness is largely federally funded, about $4 million, with $200,000 coming from the general fund. These local health, local public health preparedness grants, those are fully federal money, $18.3 million, and similar money for hospitals from the federal government is about $12.5 million. Moving on to the administrative support section of the department, the largest source of money in this activity is the Special Revenue Fund, and what that represents is money that the department takes as their indirect charges for their administrative activities on behalf of those other activities that we've just gone through. And that amount in there for the federal fund, that $11.7 million, that shows up in this area largely because of a sort of accounting timing issue, so that money isn't really spent for administrative support, but it is sitting there waiting to be allocated to other programs. And then for the general fund, there's about $15.5 million for this activity. On page 66 are some of the things you might expect to see for administrative services, rent, facilities, human resources, information technology, and such. All of the general fund money in this part of the department is spent on those activities, in addition to a lot of that indirect money from the special revenue fund, about $45 million, and another $2.6 million or so from the federal government. None of the general fund money is spent on the executive office that does those activities there, policy development, government relations, their legal activities, and their communications. They receive about $9 million through the federal government and about $6.8 million through the Special Revenue Fund. On page 67 are the other very small agencies that are in the committee's jurisdiction. The Emergency Medical Services Board, as I mentioned last week, does EMT training and certification. The Council on Disability provides advice, technical assistance, and advocacy to improve quality of life for people with disabilities. The Ombudsperson, Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Ombudsperson, works to ensure high standards in providing services to people with mental illness and developmental disorders. The Ombudsperson for Families helps families navigate government services. It receives and investigates, if necessary, complaints and provides independent support for families involved in the child welfare system. And the health-related boards, as I mentioned last week, is a collection of 16 boards that you'll see at the very end of this presentation that oversees a variety of health practitioners. All of these agencies together on page 68 receive money in from a variety of funds, about $10 million from the general fund, $30 million from the state government special revenue fund, which is what you would expect to see given that a lot of their activities, the health-related boards, are licensing boards, so they're receiving fees and using those fees to pay for their operations. For the general fund, the allocations to these, the ones that do receive general funds, and those health-related boards, by the way, don't. For these small agencies, most of the general fund goes to the Emergency Medical Services Board, and that's about $5.5 million. And the other agencies receive between $500,000 and $3 million. On pages 70 and 71, you might want to look at them together if that's possible. That is the list of the various health-related boards and the amounts that each of them receive through either the state government special revenue fund or the special revenue fund. Only two of them receive money through the special revenue fund. I believe the money for the nursing home admin board is because that is where the staff person who coordinates the administrative activity for all of these boards is funded, I believe, in that area. You can see at the bottom of page 71 there that the total for all of these boards is about $29.5 million, with most of that being from the license fees and such paid by each of them, and that money is in turn used to administer their various boards. And that, at 50 seconds left to go, is the end.
Thank you, Mr. Albrecht. And members, just to remind you, that this was intended to be an overview. I would encourage you to keep your hands on the document if you wish to help you to navigate the structure of the budget, try to get a little familiar with this. I'd also encourage you to look at, I believe we distributed the narrative from the forecast with the, each of the components of the budget. Did we distribute that to members? If we haven't, we will. But there is, after the forecast was produced, we have a document that takes, it's fairly thick, but it would take all the things that we've talked about and provide one or two pages of narrative about each of the things that are included in the budget, what activities are conducted, and also has the budget numbers in there. So again, just to give you an opportunity to get more deeply involved in what the budget structure looks like. And I would encourage you to try to find some time to look at that and be familiar with this. We're going to pursue this and have testimony from the departments as we go forward. And our next meeting will be Monday afternoon. And with that, we are adjourned.